I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services is a branch of Homeland Security. It's easy to get it confused with the other DHS divisions, including Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement. USCIS does not detain, arrest, or deport immigrants suspected of being in the country illegally. On the other hand, it's responsible for processing applications for green cards and citizenship, legal immigration, if you will. The regional district of USCIS, District 18, covers all of Central Texas, as well as the entire Texas-Mexico border and the state of New Mexico. Mario R. Ortiz is the district director for USCIS. Arwin Fitzgerald is public affairs officer with the USCIS Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico Office of Communications. Fitzgerald explains there are two different kinds of immigrants who are seeking legal entry into the U.S.
There's non-immigrant and immigrants that want to come to the United States. So non-immigrants are those who are coming to work here and stay here for a limited amount of time and then return to their home country. And they require a work visa. And there's different types of work visas. The most popular ones you hear about on the news are the H-1Bs for the high-skilled workers. But there's also H-2As for agricultural workers and H-2Bs for non-agricultural workers like construction jobs. So they all require a visa, and those are issued by the Department of State. But our role in that is the petition. So we work with the Department of Labor. They certify, oh, we do have a need for that type of person to come here because we can't fill that job. Then they file a petition with us that we approve. Then it goes to the Department of State for another level of approval, and then they get their visa.
And so there's a certain amount of time within that visa that you can stay in the United States as a non-immigrant. And so once that time is expired, what happens then with that non-immigrant?
There's two options. The employer can ask to extend for up to 3 years, depending on the type of visa. If it's a job that the employer foresees happening again, they can apply again. They can also request to change their status if their employer will sponsor them for a green card. So they can change from a non-immigrant to an immigrant visa. But that also requires a sponsor, which is normally the employer. Or if the non-immigrant gets married, it could be their spouse if they're a U.S. citizen.
And so, Mario, let's talk a little bit about some of these green cards. Who is eligible for one? A non-immigrant, like what Arwin was saying, or somebody who wants to come into the country to perhaps eventually become a citizen or just to live here legally? Do you have to obtain a green card prior to coming into the United States?
Not necessarily. But it's interesting that we ought to maybe take a step back and talk about what perhaps is the most common question that we always get asked is, well, why can't just someone come in here and get a green card? Why can't, if they've been living here for 10, 15 years on either a non-immigrant visa or here illegally, why can't they just stay here? And it's not that easy, because there's essentially a system that says in order to get a green card, you can either be married to someone here in the U.S., have an employer sponsor you. Those are generally the two most common ways of securing a green card. It's also based upon whether the individual made legal entry. In order for someone to change their status from a non-immigrant to a green card holder to a permanent resident, you need to have shown that you have made legal entry in the U.S. So it can be very quick. If you're here on one of these non-immigrant visas and you marry someone here in the U.S., the time frame is fairly short, or it can be quite lengthy if you are not here in a lawful status and then have to obtain the visa and come back in. Some of the other ways of coming in is if you're an immediate relative, a mother, a father, a brother, or sister of a U.S. citizen. And that, too, when someone becomes a citizen, then they're able to petition for their immediate relatives. Congress set a quota or number of people that we can allow in this country from particular countries. It's all based upon what you've heard is family-based migration. And there are some oversubscribed countries. So the waiting period, for instance, of a brother of a U.S. citizen from Mexico could be 17 years. The sister of someone from the Philippines could also be 15 years.
With each administration, there always seems to be a change in policy. Mario, what kind of changes have we seen in recent years to allowing the number of non-immigrants, for example, to come in with visas or to allow the members of a family of somebody who's applied for a green card? What kind of changes have happened in the last few years?
Well, I'll tell you what we've seen in the last few months. So I think that's probably really important. Yeah, let me first talk about asylum. We probably are very familiar with the surge of Central Americans along what we call the epicenter of immigration. That's in South Texas. So Central Americans, unaccompanied minors, women and children that are coming alone. And then you have all the dynamics and the challenges that come along with that. As a result of that migration, there were a lot of asylum applications that were being filed. People, as you know, were not running away from the Border Patrol. They were running to the Border Patrol. They were running to the inspectors and say, I would like to claim political asylum because of persecution in my country. There was such a surge of asylum applications that within the United States, people who were waiting for their asylum interview, now that backlog is upwards of 300,000 applications. The waiting period for the hearing to have an interview for an asylum is now well over 2 years. And so now as more and more people are coming, hundreds of officers are being deployed who normally would be adjudicating those asylum applications are now along the border listening to credible fear interviews. So now what we decided to do to change that is to say, okay, the last ones that are in are going to be the first ones that will be adjudicated. Well, we did that actually in the 1990s, and so the flow or the potential for filing frivolous applications began to dwindle because, in essence, they were not given the employment card. The interview was occurring much faster than the expected 2-year waiting period. The other thing that's different is what we call interview expansion. And that is, under executive orders that were signed, we will now be required to interview greater numbers of people on certain applications that we hadn't perhaps interviewed in the past. Some were what we call interview waiverable, that is just simply you show the right documentation and the card is issued. These are applications such as the fiancé visas that we're now interviewing all of the people who come in here as a fiancé. People who are relatives of asylees, refugees that have come into this country, when they petitioned for their family members in the past, that was not something that we interviewed locally. So the numbers of people that we will begin to interview here locally will greatly begin to expand, putting more challenges on our capacity, as a matter of fact.
And Arwin, along with so many changes in policy, there are always people who want to take advantage of somebody who might be ignorant to the actual rules and regulations. So what kind of scams and fraudulent activity have you seen relating to many of these policy changes?
That's a great question. What we've seen, and as I've said to many people, whenever there's a benefit, there's going to be fraud associated. We work really closely with the Department of Justice, and they put out a list on their website that have authorized immigration lawyers. And I highly recommend anyone who is looking for an immigration lawyer to go there first. Just because someone says they're allowed to practice immigration law does not mean they're authorized by the Board of Immigration Lawyers to do so. And it also has a list of disbarred lawyers. Also, one thing that we've been seeing a lot of are immigration applications on smartphones. A lot of them will say, hey, we can check your immigration status. We can check your case status. Give us your A file number. Give us your Social Security number. I'm here to tell you that USCIS does not have an application to check your case status for a phone. You can go to our website at uscis.gov and set up an account and you can check your case status, but please do not download any applications as they do not exist.
We're speaking with Arwin Fitzgerald, the public affairs officer with U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico Office of Communications. We're also talking with Mario R. Ortiz, district director for USCIS. When we come back, Ortiz and Fitzgerald say that despite ongoing changes in policy, they still find inspiration in their work, especially when it culminates in naturalization.
Every one of them, the naturalization ceremony, is so inspiring. It's so uplifting. And I often tell my colleagues, this is the greatest job in the world.
That's coming up right after this break. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. U.S. Citizenship and Naturalization Services is a branch of the Department of Homeland Security that handles applications for deferred action for childhood arrivals, various visas, green cards, and citizenship. Frequent changes in immigration policy make it difficult to keep up with who is and who isn't eligible for entry or residency. And many non-citizen service members who've served in the U.S. military for years have been deported. Mario Ortiz, District Director for USCIS, says the sacrifice those men and women made for their adopted country should be recognized.
First of all, many people probably don't know that there are so many thousands of young men and women who were wearing the uniform of this country and they're not even U.S. citizens. I think that's a testament to their dedication for their sacrifice for themselves and their family to say, I want to be a part of this adopted country. I think many years ago, recruiters perhaps were not quite as diligent in looking at immigration documents, and so there were promises perhaps of if you join, you will be a U.S. citizen. I saw that with a number of World War II veterans that I've met and some Vietnam veterans as well. It's a much more streamlined process now, and I think that the recruiters are much better, obviously, at looking at green card holders. But what I can tell you now is that in order to avoid anything like that happening is that an executive order was signed by President Bush in 2002 that asked us specifically as a USCIS to say, let's identify all the people who are wearing the uniform who are not yet U.S. citizens. And since that executive order was signed, there have been well over 119,000 service members who have been identified who have become U.S. citizens. We do that by identifying early on by recruitment who they are. We have a memo of agreement with Lackland Air Force Base to identify everyone at basic training who is not yet a U.S. citizen. We streamline the application, meaning we get it as fast as we can, and we waive the fee. So the whole point is to try to make sure that someone is a U.S. citizen as quick as possible after they join the U.S. military.
And what if a veteran has served undocumented? What happens in his or her case?
Well, every one of those cases is based upon whatever the circumstance is. If that happened and it came to our attention and they're still serving, then it is possible that they may be able to be adjudicated for someone who's serving honorably in the United States military, regardless of their undocumented status. Again, that happens with just extreme rarity at this point. Has it happened in the past? Sure it has.
Though DACA recipients are known to have served in the military. They are, by all intents and purposes, undocumented, but they do have the temporary work permit issued to them. From USCIS.
From USCIS.
Are there any special circumstances that might apply to DACA recipients serving in the military?
Well, that would be up to the DOD because they're the ones that set the policy on who they recruit and who they enlist. So I would have to refer you to them. But once they sign the form of honorable service and have their senior leadership sign that, then we follow our process of the naturalization process.
USCIS handles legal immigration. I know one of the big moments that happens every year is the naturalization service for the hundreds or thousands of new U.S. citizens. And I know that USCIS is going to have a really special tricentennial naturalization service coming up in May. Can you tell us more about that?
We're very excited about this. This is an opportunity to have a naturalization ceremony in front of the Alamo on May the 1st. I think there are about 50 people that will be naturalized, maybe more, as part of the San Antonio celebration. So just super excited about this one.
So for people who haven't been to a naturalization service, Arwin, can you tell us a little bit more about it?
You know, it's funny. I started working here 2 years ago, and Mario took me to my first naturalization ceremony. And I was posting all over Facebook because I'd never been to one. And it was really uplifting to see people who chose to become U.S. citizens and they play the national anthem and they place these special videos and the family and the kids that are just so excited. It's the excitement that they've accomplished such a big step in their lives. And I think my favorite part of the naturalization ceremony is afterwards when they're taking pictures with their certificates and their families and they're waiting in line to stand with the judge, to get their picture with the judge who made them a U.S. citizen. It's really uplifting. And if there's if there's an opportunity, because many of ours are open to the public in public venues like the Alamo, I highly recommend attending one because it's really moving.
I was listening to Armin describe the excitement of a naturalization ceremony, and keep in mind that I've been around for 30 years. Every one of them, the naturalization ceremony, is so inspiring. It's so uplifting. And I often tell my colleagues, this is the greatest job in the world. So where else can you be inspired, literally inspired, every day? And when immigrants come into our office, they always share their stories with us. And these are incredible, incredible stories of courage and of faith and of determination and of strength and, you know, get it done. These are the right stuff, as you would say, of people who immigrated because they really wanted to be here and make a difference. And then they share those stories with us. And we as public servants feel this is the greatest thing that we get to do in life. Then we go home and we hug our spouses and our children and say we're blessed to have these jobs. So Arwin is right when we talk about the excitement at a naturalization ceremony. I wish that every U.S. citizen could attend a naturalization ceremony. And I wish every middle schooler and high school could attend a naturalization ceremony, understand what it means on that day to pledge the allegiance and the oath of allegiance to this country. It is so meaningful.
Mario R. Ortiz is District Director for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, and Arwin Fitzgerald is Public Affairs Officer with USCIS Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico Office of Communications. Finding the Art Legacy Gallery in San Antonio is a bit of a challenge. It's located in the lobby of a home builder's office, but there's no signage declaring its existence. But upon entering the narrow space, you're greeted by a Warhol-inspired pop art Einstein-like portrait of an older man sticking out his tongue at you. What's most striking is his bright pink tongue and blue shirt. Everything else is gray. That's famed author Gabriel Garcia Marquez. You're also greeted by two Frida Kahlo portraits. You might not realize it at first, but Frida's brows are familiarly bushy in one, but plucked cleanly above the nose in the other. These are just a few works featured in the Latino Faces exhibition by San Antonio architect and graphic designer Analy Diego. Diego doesn't put pen, pencil, ink, or watercolor to canvas to create these bright, arresting images. She simply unfolds her laptop. She calls this type of art vector art.
So vector art is digital art. It is art drawn on the computer using a stylus pen. Some people use a mouse, but I use a stylus pen. And a lot of people might consider it to be maybe the newest type of art, but it's been around for a while. I think it can adapt to many mediums, which is great, many substrates, and it can be done in many sizes. So it can really adapt to many formats.
Diego works with existing photographs before making them her own.
Essentially, the photograph is just a basis so I can get the contours right. And then I make changes according to what I feel like. I am a big fan of color and high contrast of color. Like you had mentioned before, my art looks very Warhol inspired, and he is definitely one of my main inspirations. He was a master of color use, and I teach color theory. So that's how the tie of architecture and design and art happened for me.
Diego explains how she uses color to frame the face of former First Lady of Argentina, Eva Perón.
When I was researching for the right image to use as a reference, most of her images are in black and white, and I wanted the collection to be a lot of fun and very original, and I wanted her to pop. I chose a teal, very deep teal, as the background with a high saturated red lip for her, and then definitely the blonde hair, so that those three colors work very well together and they actually frame the face if you really look at it, because the face itself is very neutral and it's framed by the hair and the lips at equal proportions.
And among the other familiar faces of Selena, the San Antonio Spurs' Manu Ginobili, and soccer star Pelé are a couple of less familiar, no less arresting portraits. One is of 85-year-old French-born Mexican journalist Elena Poniatowska, who's thoughtfully, gently smiling at you while cradling her face in her hands. And the other, directly to Poniatowska's left, is Mexican realist, painter, and muralist David Alfaro Siqueiros, wearing a bright red shirt and pointing right at you as if singling you out in the gallery. And further down the hall, tucked away in a corner by a fire alarm, are visionary fashion designers Oscar de la Renta and Carolina Herrera. You may notice that many of the subjects of Diego's portraits are above a certain age.
I've always enjoyed hanging out with older people and my grandparents. I would always touch their face because I find their wrinkles so interesting. So it's the same for when I draw. I really like to draw older people because they have just so much detail. And it kind of shows kind of like the journey that they've been through.
Whether a rebel, a politician's influential wife, an NBA star, or a Colombian novelist with a winking sense of humor, these Latino faces take you on a brightly colored journey that illustrates the wide footprint the Latino community has made on this very diverse planet. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produce the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. And Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.